But now on BBC Radio 4, Birds and the Battlefield. Frank Gardner, the BBC's security correspondent, and himself a keen bird watcher, examines the relationship between soldiers and birds through the military engagements of the past century, from the diaries and letters home of those on the Western Front during the First World War to the direct testimony of those now serving in Iraq and Afghanistan.
There was one particular occasion where I was taking somebody out on a guided tour. He was replacing my boss out there. So I said, come on, you know, jump the Land Rover and I'll take you off to the other batteries and I'll introduce you to people, show you around and the ropes and stuff. And we were driving down the road. And as we were going along, I spotted this Egyptian vulture on this telegraph pole. And I was like, oh my God, is that Egyptian vulture? So I hit the brakes and I jumped out of my Land Rover, grabbing my binoculars. And this other guy was leaping out the other side, cocking his weapon. And I'm like, what are you doing? What are you doing? He said, we're getting attacked. I said, no, it's an Egyptian vulture. I just wanted to see the Egyptian vulture. And he just really kind of lost it. He went, they told me about you. They said you were like this. I said, put your gun away and come and watch this bird. And he's like, you're mad, you're mad. But we laughed about it afterwards. He saw the funny side of it.
A soldier with a passion for birds. That was Sergeant Geoffrey McMullen, who served in the Royal Artillery for 22 years. I'm Frank Gardner, and I share his fondness for birdwatching. In this programme, I'll be looking at the sometimes surprising link between soldiers and birds, and I'll be examining the curious comfort soldiers get from such an interest in times of extreme stress. It's a thread we can trace all the way back from those now serving in Iraq and Afghanistan to their First World War compatriots. One of those was John William Streets, a sergeant in the 12th York and Lancaster Regiment, who was something of a poet.
Hushed is the shriek of hurtling shells, and hark! Somewhere within that bit of soft blue sky, grand in his loneliness, his ecstasy, his lyric wild and free, carols a lark.
John William Streets was killed on the first day of the Somme offensive in 1916. His poem, A Lark Above the Trenches, was published posthumously.
I in the trench, he lost in heaven afar, I dream of love. Its ecstasy, he sings, doth lure my soul to love till like a star it flashes into life. Oh, tireless wings, that beat love's message into melody, a song that touches in this place remote gladness supreme in its undying note, and stirs to life the soul of memory. 'Tis strange that while you're beating into life, men here below are plunged in sanguine strife.
It wasn't only those with a talent for poetry who felt a connection with birds. Ordinary soldiers, stuck in the trenches, conveyed the horrors of the First World War in diaries and letters home. In the midst of their life and death struggle, many found relaxation and comfort in the natural world. This was reported in the newspapers at the time, such as the officer of a London regiment who stood for half an hour beside a plover's nest to prevent the eggs being trampled on by his passing troops. A Scottish miner, killed shortly afterwards on the Western Front, told a friend,
"If it weren't for the birds, what a hell it would be. I watch them singing, and something comes into my throat that makes me almost greet."
This Scottish miner's sentiments are echoed almost 100 years on by Sergeant McMullen.
I was part of the first NATO troops into Bosnia, which was the I-4. Yeah. We used to stick GOT on the end of that. I forgot. Yeah. I was actually based in a place called Yaitza. Beautiful, beautiful little place. Nice castle on the hill. Obviously, the devastation was all around. So in amongst all that devastation, there was this real beauty as well. There was hedgerows everywhere. Every bush that you passed as you drove down the road had a red-backed shrike singing from it, you know. Golden orioles were literally wall to wall, you know. I had my first wryneck nest in an orchard, which is another woodpecker, you know. I'd just sit there for hours and look at these birds, you know. It was just absolutely tremendous.
Well, I've certainly found birdwatching to be a great stress reliever. In 2003, I was in Basra, staying in the grounds of Saddam's palace there, soon after the Iraq invasion. We'd come back in from accompanying a British Army patrol around the city, take off our flak jackets and helmets, and I'd just go off with my binoculars and unwind by birdwatching along the canals and fields within the palace walls. There'd be colourful bee-eaters, plovers, and these incredibly noisy birds called Iraq babblers. Back in the First World War, a man called, ironically, Charles Raven, volunteered for service in France in 1917 as a frontline army chaplain. He wrote about his experiences in a book called In Praise of Birds, published after the war.
A more irritable battalion could hardly have been found. tramping past the wreck that had once been Arras, over that accursed ridge, and on, when darkness came, into a poisonous row of Boche dugouts, verminous within and shell-visited without. Settling in was a dismal business. We were too sore even to grumble. And then, in the morning, the miracle happened. Headquarters was in an old signaller's station, and its entrance was festooned with German wires and decorated with insulators. On one of these, a pair of swallows were building. Those birds were angels in disguise, bringing instant relief to the nerves and tempers of the mess. They were utterly fearless, flying in and out among the sandbags, making the nest ready for its treasures. My companions staked large sums on the date of the first egg's arrival. We all regarded the pair with devoted affection. Never was a nest so protected. Elaborate rules were composed for its welfare. The nest was on no account to be touched or, except once daily, inspected. For inspection, a trench periscope or shaving mirror was to be used, and the result, since money would change hands over it, was to be officially verified. No one was to wear a tin hat near the nest, and strangers were to be warned of its position. When the battalion was relieved, the nest and the rules regarding it were to be handed over with a special request that details of its progress should be fully chronicled and reported. When the Boche celebrated Whit Sunday by an extra dose of fire, our chief anxiety was lest a stray fragment might harm the birds. No one could be downhearted when the early stand-to was terminated by the carolling of the cock, and we rushed back to see whether the hen had laid overnight. Blessed birds! For me, they revived ancient joys and heralded many hours of rest and stored refreshment.
Bosnian Serb troops have been advancing on the UN-designated safe area of Srebrenica, detaining United Nations soldiers as they move forward. Three UN observation posts have been overrun, and Serb tanks are reported to be at the edge of the town.
When you're living in a small room with six guys for 6 months, it can do your head in a little bit, you know? So you need to find your own space. Well, I did, so I found this nice little place by the river that nobody else was really aware of, and I would just sit there and just watch the dippers come down, listen to the honey buzzards flying overhead, wagtails, whatever, you know. So it was just a very special place for me, and I found it quite therapeutic to be able to do that, you know. And in the background I'd hear people shouting my name. I felt I needed that bit of downtime, you know, where I could just go off and be on my own and have that privacy. And because I managed to find this little niche, because it was a factory we were based in, I found this little niche of nature tucked away in the corner of this factory that nobody else knew about. You know, it's quite brilliant. There was lots of little gems all over the place, you know, without the conflict around and all that kind of stuff. Bosnia was a real kind of paradise for birding. The long-legged buzzard, there was pygmy cormorant, there was all sorts. You've got different habitats as you're going along and picking up different birds, black storks out on the plains, bittern and stuff like that. So, quite an experience.
The Daily News of the 8th of June 1917 carried a report from H. Perry Robinson on the artillery prelude to the British assault on Ypres.
The sun, as it rose, was invisible behind the bank of smoke, but it flushed the sky above with red. It was a truly terrible dawn, most beautiful in its terror, and if ever dawn did indeed come up like thunder, it was this. Then came the greatest miracle of all, for with the rose flush in the sky, the whole bird chorus of morning came to life. Never, surely, did birds sing so. Blackbird and thrush, lark and blackcap and willow warbler. Most of the time their voices, of course, were inaudible. But now and again, in the intervals of the shattering noise of the guns, their notes pealed up as if each bird was struck with frenzy and was striving to shout down the guns.
BBC Radio 4. It's 6 o'clock. The news with Carolyn Brown. Good evening.
There's been a major new development in the war in Iraq. Kurdish guerrillas have entered the northern city of Kirkuk, the centre of the country's oil fields. British military officials in the southern city of Basra say the looting...
The air base is quite large, and there was actually a local bus service to get us from one end of the camp to the other. It was just a hop-on, hop-off bus service run by the locals, or manned by the locals, I should say.
Corporal Sue Berikloth of the 4624 Movement Squadron managed to pursue her interest in birds while serving in Iraq. And we shouldn't forget that under Saddam, this was a country completely out of bounds to birdwatchers for years.
Where I wanted to go birding, it was actually off the beaten track, so I had to take a bus and then walk the last distance, which you might think, no problem at all, but you consider that the basics we had on were civilian clothes plus heavy body armour and our helmets. There was a rule that we had to be within 20 metres or 20 seconds running distance of our body armour and helmet. And then binoculars, camera as well. So I had about 20 kilograms worth of extra gear to carry each day.
In spite of the practical difficulties, Corporal Berikloth recognises the value to her of her hobby.
It was great to be able to do something like that because it gave me a focus. You can just switch off for a few minutes and concentrate on the birds, and I love that. It added a little bit of sanity to what was a very different environment for me. It meant I could continue doing something that I used to do back home in UK. I could take my pictures and I could bring them home and show my partner. It was a link with reality.
We can see that same focus and link with reality that Corporal Berikloth talks about there in John Buxton's definitive book about the redstart, a small, attractive European bird. He carried out the research for this while he was a prisoner of war. Early in 1940, Buxton, a commando involved in the Norwegian campaign, was taken prisoner by the Germans and sent to Eichstätt, a camp deep in the Bavarian countryside. There he was incarcerated for the rest of the war, but instead of digging escape tunnels, he organised his fellow prisoners in regular observations of a pair of redstarts.
I was able to gather together a mass of notes on one pair covering 850 hours in the months of April, May and June 1943. No pair of birds has ever been watched so continuously, with their every movement recorded. And this could not have been done, even in prison, without the willing and conscientious help of many of my fellows. To them, I can do no more than offer my best thanks for their work. And I think they will agree that some of our most delightful hours in those years were spent, pencil in hand, watching the bewildering actions of those two redstarts. One of the chief joys of watching them in prison was that they inhabited another world than I. They lived only in the moment, without foresight, and with memory only of things of immediate practical concern to them. Unconcerned in our fatuous politics, they lived wholly and enviably to themselves.
7:15. British troops have started building what will be their largest base in Afghanistan. It's Camp Bastion in Helmand province.
Camp Bastion's in the middle of the Helmand Desert. It's a large camp. It's about 12 kilometres in perimeter of the camp, and it contains all the British and NATO forces for Afghanistan. It wasn't there 2-3 years ago, so any birds flying over see the lights and drop down, so it's large enough to birdwatch. Towards the end of the tour, we'd built our own water bottling plant from an aquifer. Locals being the locals, would fill their vehicles up and leave the taps running, so there was always standing water around the bottling plant.
Captain Richard Sargent of the UK Joint Forces Medical Group in Helmand Province, back from a tour of duty in Afghanistan, another country that's long been off the beaten track for most birdwatchers.
You don't want to walk around Camp Bastion in the middle of the day when it's too hot, so my birding was either done first thing in the morning or last thing at night, just before last light. Last light was usually about 1900 hours, so I had an hour or two to wander around before supper. The water bottling plant attracted warblers. They're a long-distance migrant flying from north of the Hindu Kush down into India or even down into Africa. So these birds would fly over, see water, drop straight down, and it was a good focal point for the birds. It was a cracking opportunity, and it's obviously a good way of getting out of the normal routine.
Captain Sargent previously served in Desert Storm, the Gulf War of 1991, where he made use of some rather unusual birdwatching equipment.
During the First Gulf War, I was part of an armoured crew with the Grenadier Guards in an armoured vehicle called a Warrior, and I had the opportunity to use a tank site to birdwatch. A tank sight's very good. In some respects, it's much better than a pair of binoculars. You see the birds much closer. Obviously, at distance, you're better off using a pair of binoculars. You do notice birds. If you're stuck in a tank, you're thinking about what's going to happen next. You're thinking about what's just happened, and it's something to take your mind off things. Actually, seeing a hoopoe fly over in the distance.
From somewhere the other side of the hill, an 88 opened up, but its shells landed in the valley. Half an hour went by and still nothing happened. Then the cuckoos began calling. There were two of them. Their early notes cheered us up no end.
Rifleman Alex Bulby, writing during the Second World War when he was under German fire in Italy.
Down in the valley, a bird began singing. Were the gunners signalling to a patrol sent to sniff us out? But as the bird sang on, I realised that no human could reproduce such perfection. It was a nightingale. And as if showing us and the Germans that there were better things to do, it opened up until the whole valley rang with song. Once again, I sensed a tremendous affirmation that this would go on. Only this time, the wonder of it overwhelmed me. I could only lie there and let it pour in.
I wake up quite early. I kind of wake up about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And on this occasion, I could hear somebody playing a flute. And I'm like, no, I'm just hearing things. You know, no, certainly none of my guys would play a flute. And that's not being derogatory or anything. It's just not the kind of thing they would do, you know. Kick a ball around, yeah, but play a flute? No. So I didn't pay it much attention. But then the next morning, the same again happened. The morning after that, it happened again. I thought, right, OK, somebody's definitely playing a flute here, so I'm going to find out who it is. So I had, when we had our morning orders session, at the end of that, I said, right, guys, I've got a question for you. So I've got about 50 guys here. I said, which one of you is playing a flute at 5 o'clock in the morning? And they just looked at me as if I'd literally landed it, you know, from Mars or something. And they're going, what are you on about, boss? We don't play. I said, somebody's playing a flute at 5 o'clock in the morning. I want to know who it is. Well, no, you've lost it, boss. This whole scenario's got to you. You're cracking up. So, well, I'm going to find out. So the next morning, I was really determined to find out who it was. So I woke up. I could hear this flute again. Right, I'm going to catch this person. So I got up and I followed the sound, and it literally took me around several sand dunes until I came around this other sand dune, and I realised that the sound wasn't actually a flute. It was coming from way up in the air from a bird called a hoopolark, which kind of flies up. And what it does, when it reaches its highest point, it drops like a stone, but it tumbles on the way singing. So as it's singing, its song is kind of shooting out in all different directions, if you like, and bouncing off the sand dunes. So by the time it got to my ear, where I was in my sleeping bag at 5 o'clock in the morning, to me it sounded like a flute. And I have to say that for me was one of the most beautiful sounds I've ever heard in my life. You know, it was just, you know, here I am in a desert about to go and do what we're supposed to do. And there's this amazing bird that just has this astonishing song in the middle of the desert. It's just really one of the most beautiful sounds you could ever wish to hear. A special moment in amongst all the chaos again, you know. That was a very, very lovely time.
Air raid warning threat. Red attack is now imminent. Hands to emergency station.
First reports indicate that about 20 men are missing from HMS Ardent and about 30 are injured.
During the Falklands campaign, Surgeon Commander Philip Jones, RN, served on board the Canberra. After the Argentinian bombardment, he dealt with more than just the human casualties.
As a result of the engagements, quite a lot of oil had escaped from these sunken ships, and in particular the Ardent and the Antelope, and it acted as a slick which damaged some of the birds. In particular, the diving petrels, which are quite difficult to see. They're rather small, little black and white birds, little like a very miniature penguin. But they live on the surface of the sea rather than underneath. And they were being damaged by being oiled up. But we use fairy liquid to wash the feathers off and then dry them with hair dryers. I think the active process of cleaning them up and releasing them again acted as certainly a stabilising point, taking me away from the scenario of some of the nasty cases I was having to deal with surgically at the time. the nature of battle casualty injuries is such that there's a time base whereby they occur. You carry out the first initial surgery and then you carry out further surgery. So therefore, we were almost running a completely 24-hour service, so to speak. And this was a useful break of time to go and have a relax, to keep yourself sane almost. On the day of the surrender, well, when I actually went ashore, in fact, into Stanley, we could see in the distance over where the trenches had been shelled just prior to the surrender, the flock of Karakaras. There must have been about 30 of them. They're a bit like a large, very large sparrowhawk almost. Karakaras being carrion-eating birds, tackling the remains of some of the unfortunates that had been involved in the attack, scavengers, just picking at the dead.
Birdwatching in the Falklands wasn't always a gloomy experience for Commander Jones. There were also moments of pure joy.
The peak of the birdwatching for me was seeing the flocks, or rather rafts, of light-mantled sooty albatross. They're a gorgeous-looking grey and chocolatey-brown bird, but they look so clumsy to start off with. And as the camera approached them, you'd see them becoming alarmed and paddling a little bit quicker to get away, and then finally realising they had to take off, waddling away from the bow and then gliding off into the distance, about 300 of them. So dramatic when there's a large number of them, and when they're such beautiful-looking birds.
In the June 1918 edition of the journal British Birds, we find a forerunner of Commander Jones, another naval surgeon, J.M. Harrison, who describes his area of the Aegean as offering a veritable paradise for the ornithologist.
Here it has been my good fortune to meet with such birds as the crested lark, the hoopoe, to see the roller at its aerial stunts, to say nothing of a host of other smaller birds, including some of the rarer wheatears and chats, the red-rumped swallow and the black-headed bunting. The above condensation, memorised as far as has been possible from my ornithological diary, which was lost with the rest of my effects and some interesting specimens with my ship M28 in the action on January the 20th, will give some idea of the attractions offered to the field naturalist in Macedonia, and may be of interest to others about to embark OHMS for that quarter, and help to send them on their way 1 degree cheerier, and hold out some consolation for foreign service in wartime.
British Bird still exists as a monthly magazine for avid birdwatchers, although now those serving abroad tend to email its website rather than post letters. Some communicate their sightings in internet blogs, a method favoured by Captain Richard Sargent.
Two yellow wagtails of the race Lutea were flushed on Tuesday, just as a flock of 30-plus trumpeter finches flew overhead. During a run on Thursday, I glimpsed a distinct outline. The AOS, the Army Ornithological Society, have probably got about 200 members, possibly more than 200 members. A lot of them are retired officers or retired soldiers, but there's a hard core of us, probably about 20, 30, who are serving members who meet up on a regular basis.
After the Gulf War, Richard and I, and another friend of ours, an English guy who lived in Germany, and he was ex-RAF, we had arranged to meet up and do a birding trip. Anyway, we all jumped in this car to head off birding for the day. And it was quite soon after the war, and he was like in the back of the car and he said, "Right, so what was it like?" And Richard pipes up, "Well, you know, when I was at such and such a place in Saudi, I had a squacco heron in the middle of the desert." And I was like, "Yeah, I dipped out on an eagle owl in the ammo compound. I couldn't believe it. I missed it by minutes." And he's going, no, "What was the war like?" And we both went quite casually, "Well, you probably know more about it than we do because you saw it on TV." Anyway, there was this bird and he just couldn't believe it. And he was telling us later that he went back to work the next day and he was telling his German colleagues this conversation. And they were just like, "The Brits are mad." they're out here about to go and do, you know, a conflict or whatever, and all they can do is talk about birds, you know. And he just wanted kind of like the meaty war stories, and we were like, "Well, sorry, you know, but there was some good bird watching to be had." And they just couldn't get their heads around that concept.
Someone who found himself in a similar situation was Richard Richardson, who later became one of Britain's best-known bird artists. He served with the Royal Norfolk Regiment during the Second World War.
"Once or twice a messmate has asked me what kick I get out of studying birds. And often, as I pause to find an answer, I detect a tiny gleam of triumph in his eyes when he sees I cannot answer straight away. It is difficult at once to say what the attractions are, for there are certainly more than one. On careful thought, however, they can usually be unearthed. Firstly, their unsurpassable beauty of flight and shape. Their trim, neat and perfectly designed plumage. Their voices, unselfishness, faith, courage, self-sacrifice, their domestic affairs and their good spirits and cheerfulness. In fact, everything that most humans find so difficult to copy and adhere to. Even now I feel there is something unexplained. Can it be that it is this? They take one into communion with God and were given to the world by Him to be the pattern on which man should model his life. I feel I've hit the nail on the head.
The religious explanation offered by Richard Richardson is a personal one, and it may not be shared by other birdwatchers. But birds on the battlefield do seem to engender a feeling of renewal from the lowest to the highest rank. Field Marshal Lord Allenbrooke, the Chief of Staff of Britain's Armed Forces at the time, writes in his diary during the Second World War, "These occasional spells of birdwatching did marvels as a means of recreation. I was able for a short spell to forget the war," he says, "all the nightmare of responsibility. Those 2 hours in a hide close to a marsh tit at its nest made Winston and the war disappear in a cloud of smoke. It was like rubbing Aladdin's lamp. I was transported," he said, "to a fairyland, and returned infinitely refreshed and recreated." Well, I can certainly relate to that, because I remember taking time out from covering the Palestinian Intifada, the uprising, in Jerusalem, to watch two kingfishers chase each other round a pond next to the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. But I can think of no better ending for this programme than Siegfried Sassoon's poem Everyone Sang. It was written to celebrate the signing of the armistice on November the 11th, 1918, bringing the carnage of the First World War to an end. It's spoken by the poet himself.
Everyone suddenly burst out singing, and I was filled with such delight as prisoned birds must find in freedom, winging wildly across the white orchards and dark green fields, on and out of sight. Everyone's voice was suddenly lifted, and beauty came like the setting sun. My heart was shaken with tears, and horror drifted away. Oh, but everyone was a bird, and the song was wordless, the singing will never be done.